Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this VGC podcast special, our review special for Dragon's Dogma, who I have assembled some of our apparently recurring review crew to do this review special. Joining us once again is Alex Donaldson from VG247 and RPG site, and Jade King from The Gamer. Now, we'll start this the way we started Final Fantasy VII review cast. Alex, give me, you're allowed one paragraph, your overall thoughts on Dragon's Dogma 2.
It's one of the best games of the last 20 years, but you have to be the right sort of person who gets it. And I do think it is going to be a Marmite game. You're going to see like review scores. You're going to see tens. I'm sure you're going to see people come in with like sixes as well, because it's not easy. It's not necessarily easy to love, but it is an incredible, incredible piece of work.
Okay. Jade?
I don't think I've played a game, God, it might be in the past decade, that captures like a sense of adventure quite like this one does, both in its like combat, its open world, like the monster design and the camaraderie of like working with your pawns and stuff. It is going to be divisive, but I don't think that jank and some of those frustrations should take away from like how brilliant a game this is when you get it. Like, as Alex said, when it clicks, and you just, I've been thinking about it all week.
It took me a little while to get onto its terms, but once I did, like, it reminded me of, and it's not like this game at all, but in the way that it sparked my imagination, it reminded me of the first time I played Fallout 3, which is one of my favorite games of all time, and it was just like, it was one of the first RPGs of that style I ever played, maybe the first one that I engaged with in that level, and I was like, oh my god, this whole world and all these people are going about doing their things, and if you do this over here, it'll impact this over there. And
big inspiration though on the original,
because Skyrim was sort of the
this is the thing that I think is fascinating about both the first game and this game. So like you think about when the first Dragon's Dogma came out and when it entered production and stuff like that. It entered production, and while that game was in production, Oblivion came out, Fable 2 came out, and Fallout 3 came out, and these were all games that Itsuno at the time name-checked and talked about as being inspirations. But then by the time the game was done, Dragon's Dogma came out, and it came out like 3 or 4 months after Skyrim. And similarly, it came out a little bit after Dark Souls. So you'd had Demon's Souls, and you'd had that sort of as this weird fluke cult hit that Sony even refused to publish in the West, and Atlas picked it up and made a huge success out of it. And then you had Dark Souls come out and sort of prove that actually that wasn't a fluke. But all those things happened too late for Dragon's Dogma or Itsuno-san or for his team to react to it. And now you have this game, and you look at what's happened in this genre since then, and it's like we've had the effect of games like Red Dead and Red Dead 2 on these open world games, which has led to and inspired stuff like our first open world Zelda and our first open world Final Fantasies. And you've also obviously had the Souls series continue to grow, and Elden Ring, and you've had Fallout 4, and Starfield, I suppose. But what's interesting is that this game is remarkably unbothered by all of that. Despite the fact it was inspired by those earlier games, Itsuno had a path that was set, had a feeling about where he wanted to go. And so this game is really refreshingly unbothered about anything else that has happened in the industry and in its genre since. It's only really interested in having a conversation with and working around one game, and that's the original Dragon's Dogma. Mm. And I find that really interesting. And it's actually really refreshing, because obviously the last time us three were together, right, we were talking about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. And that is the opposite, where they've gone, what can we take from The Witcher? What can we take from a Ubisoft game? What can we take from this? Let's have towers. Let's have Fall Guys minigames, all that sort of stuff. this is the other end of, and this isn't to say, you know, I enjoyed Final Fantasy a great deal, as me on the podcast last time sort of attests to. But what's really interesting is this is the polar opposite of that, where it's just like, we're going to take what we did in the first game, we're going to do it again, we're going to go our own way. Because I think there will be a lot of people who compare it to Souls and to Skyrim and stuff like that. But the interesting thing is, the place it comes from is, I had this debate with someone on Twitter, and they were like, well, actually, Souls came out before. And I was like, yes, but it was so close that really it was more like a Ant's Bug's Life.
Yeah.
Situation, or what's it like, Armageddon, and what's that other?
Deep Impact.
Yeah, it was more like one of those situations where two people arrived in a roughly similar place, but actually also quite different at the same time, almost by coincidence. But I'm really refreshed that they didn't feel the need to go, oh, how have open worlds evolved over the last? But it's interesting to me, with that in mind, that you Fallout 3 comes to mind for you straight away.
Yeah.
Because that is where sort of the genesis is in those very first open world console games.
The moment that came to me was, one of the quests was like, go and speak to this person. And modern game design in 2024 would put a marker on that person, would highlight them, would basically just drag them towards you. And instead it was just like, they're in the town, like you can just go and kind of look for them. And if they're not there, go for a sleep, come back, that kind of thing. And I was like, okay, this is operating in a different kind of stratosphere, and that's mm-hmm. what I think plays to what you said about it being a Marmite game, because there will be people that are just so turned off by like some of the kind of obtuse mission design. And there's two things. Some of the missions are obtuse. There have been a few times, there have been two times to be specific, where mission sequencing has broken for me completely, and it hasn't like acknowledged that. That could be a bug, that could be whatever, but there's always someone, be it like Bran early on or other characters later on, where if you go back to them and badger them, they'll eventually get to the point where they're like, just go down to this person and talk to them here and they'll tell you. But if you just want to go and like explore it on your own, I walked into so many things that talk to a random person and then two things check off, and I was like, oh, okay, this was something I wasn't planning on doing for a long time. It's very exciting.
I think a good example is like, there's a mission where you have to sneak into the castle, and anything I use will be an early example. In the main narrative, we have to sneak into the castle and you have to search for something in someone's room that you think is being nefarious. And it puts a general waypoint on the room and the surrounding area, but nothing else. And, you know, I suppose a minor spoiler for the solution in that quest, if you're really sensitive. But it turns out this guy's got a hidden wall, a hidden door in his room. But whereas in a lot of games, that would have big-ass Legend of Zelda crack in the wall, obvious sort of telltale. Or it would literally, you know, have a button prompt. So if you got close enough to the wall, it'd say press B to open. This doesn't have any of that. And so I did two or three laps of that room, and then I walked around the rest of the castle and I was like, what is going on? And then I went back up to the room and went, oh, and I felt like an idiot. But I feel like a lot of people will bounce off that a little bit. Or like, there's a quest where a young lad gets abducted by wolves from one of the towns, and you're tasked with tracking him down. And what it does is it literally just asks, it tells you to speak to NPCs in the town, and you do that. You have to read what they say, because it doesn't necessarily put it into the quest log. You can go back and speak to them again, but it's not like you speak to someone and what would happen in What would happen in Elder Scrolls is it would go speak to the villagers, and it would say, and it would have zero out of three. And yeah. after you spoke to the first one, it'd go 1 out of 3, 2 out of 3, 3 out of 3. This is like, you go and speak to the people around. It doesn't give you any of that sort of tactile feedback. When you feel like you've gathered enough information, you're like, okay, so they're saying it's in a cemetery. He was last seen in a cemetery to the east. And another person is saying that he was going to pick a certain type of flowers. So then you go to the cemetery and find the flowers, and you follow the path of those flowers to, and that eventually leads you to a cave. And the quest log, the waypoint, gives you zero help with that. And furthermore, that's a timed quest. So if you're not quick enough about it, the boy dies. So
guess who wasn't quick enough about it? Because I got to that cemetery, but I got there at night, and like different enemies spawn at night, and these like extremely tough enemies spawned there, and I was like, oh well, this is clearly the, I'll beat these guys and then the wee boy will come out or something like that. I just got my hole punched over and over and over again, and then eventually I was like, so what if maybe I have to maybe he's in a coffin and I have to revive him or something like that. But then I went down to the cave. Yeah, it's full of stuff.
I just love
like that
you can. I love that you can do that though. Like, I told you this story right about. I told you this story during the review period where I screwed myself over early in the game because I made the decision very early on. Basically, as soon as I'd done the first couple of main missions and was set loose. There's two key countries in the game. There's Vermund and Batal. And I was like, I want to go to Batal. So I found my way to the border. And then at the border, there was a border checkpoint and they wanted to see my documents and stuff like that. And I didn't have any documents. And I tried a few things to try and get through. There was a mask that I bought that I thought might get me through. Yeah. That didn't work. Although that does work later, ironically, but there's some stuff attached to it. You need the paperwork as well as the mask. But someone else was going through the border legitimately in a cart. And so I just waited until the last minute until they were going through the open gates. And I just sprinted and hopped on the back of this cart and rode it through the gates. What I didn't think about is that's obviously a later game area, a higher level area. And the gate closed behind me. I didn't have any paperwork to get back through the gate. And I was in this super high level area and I was basically just screwed. And the phrase I use in my review is I made a Dark Souls of my own making because I just put myself in this horrible pit and I was looking and I was like, right, I can't get back through the gate. I don't have any map revealed for this area and there's no towers or anything. The only way you can reveal map is to physically traverse over that land. I was like, so where's the nearest city? I can't really see any obvious settlements looking out over the terrain. So I'm just going to follow the main road. There are loads of really difficult enemies. I tried to camp and because I was using a low level early game, crappy camping kit, I got raided. So I didn't even get a full night's rest, didn't get my health restoration and I had to fight off the enemies. And it was just, it went from lovely breezy RPG adventuring to like a survival game for 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
And to be fair, there is always a, and this is important for people to understand, right? A big element of this game is that there's one save file. So if you make a decision in a quest, for instance, like there's a quest where I made a decision about a character that was living a double life, and the decision I made was one of his two wives killed him and herself. And I was like, wow, that's not a good outcome for that quest. but it saves so instantly afterwards. There's no going back. But it keeps two saves. So there's the auto save. And whenever you manually save, that's one save. But then it also keeps your last in rest. But when I crossed that border, I hadn't had an in rest for like an hour and a half. So if I did load my last in rest to get back to safety, I would have lost like an hour and a half of progress, which sounds horrible and brutal, and it is. But the beauty of that is it forced me out of my comfort zone to, rather than back up and just go back, to force me to find a way through that area, to get to the town by the skin of my teeth. And then in the town, I was able to buy one of the key items that you can use. Fast travel is a consumable. So I was able to buy one of those and finally fast travel back to where I was supposed to be.
Yeah.
but I just love that it's the sort of game that can inspire that sort of thinking. You know, I love that it's only one save file. I love that it's quite brutal in terms of doesn't give you a chance to check things. I love that it's quite tactile. So it's like a mission where you need to arrest someone. And I was like, how do I arrest them? There's no dialogue option going, you're under arrest. No Commander Shepard thing.
Yeah.
And then I just realized, oh, I can just press use R2 and grapple them. And I grappled them and that pushed them down to the ground. And I was like, that's it. And I love that as well. Yeah.
So on the fast travel thing, I'll come to you this with this next, Jade. It is a consumable. It's an item that's quite rare at in the outset of the game, and you have to establish fast travel points in order to go back to them and things like this. Initially, I was like, "Oh, that's annoying," but I think one of the strengths of the game is I know that map really, really well now. Like, I know both those cities incredibly well. I know the paths to get back and forth, and it's almost like From Soulsian when like a connection between them opens up and you're like, oh, okay, that's a shortcut. I think that stuff's great. And then late in the game, when I when I got to this point, it just starts throwing them at you. Like, I have like 25 of that item at this point.
Yeah.
And I would have begged for, like, there was points back in the day where I would have begged for one. And also there's a checkpoint town, and there's a little dodgy shop that will sell you certain items you need for quests, and will sell you forgeries and stuff like that. I wasn't paying attention to an item description, and I bought a fake fast travel item.
So I was just standing. So good.
I was standing in the middle of a road, desperate to get home, and I was like, okay, finally, we're out of this fight. I can get home. And he just throws it, and it's just a pebble that rolls across the ground. It's like, that was a fake one. That was a fake item I've just used. And I was like, okay, Capcom, fine. What a game. I agree. Jade, how did you find the fast travel system? How did you find it compared to the modern way of thinking where you're just zipping across big open worlds?
I love that Dragon's Dogma 2 just doesn't give a shit, but in, like, the best possible way.
Yeah.
Because, like, it only cares about, like, building on the original game, and that includes, like, some of the fast travel stuff it does. But it kind of changed my way of thinking when it comes to modern open world games, because there's always an easy way out. Like, even in games that, like, invite that sort of experimentation, like the modern Zelda games and stuff, you can still find safety or get your way out. But there were, like, 40-minute stretches in this game where I was, like, stranded, had hardly any health. It was pitch darkness, and I didn't really know where I was going other than following a mark on the map towards the town I just came from. And when you get that fast travel item, and mine wasn't fake, it's almost like a eureka rewarding moment, despite it being really insignificant. And I think it can get frustrating, I think. And this game does kind of, like, force you down, like, almost, it's bad to call it realistic. I'd more call it, like, ruthless, where it can get frustrating. But I think the brilliant gameplay design and the stuff it encourages you to do outweighs that. To the point where I am now, about 20 hours in, I think I've fast traveled like twice, like, in the entire game. I've just been walking everywhere. That's probably why I'm not getting anything done.
Yeah, I think it works in terms of, this isn't a game that's abundant with massive cities or anything like that. It makes the cities are really deep. It makes it count. There's so many characters in each of the cities, so many different quests threads. I think that works very well. Right at the end of the game, you can open up the map and you've still not seen, like, tons of it. Like, it's very deliberate in the fact that if you just follow the main path, there will be huge swaths of the map that are completely dark, but you can see, if you zoom in on the map, you can see the outlines, gray outlines, and you can be like, okay, that's a straight road that goes into, like, a cul-de-sac with little bits off it. I bet that's a town. Let's go and see what that is. Alex, were you... So when it comes to the main story, I don't love the main, like... I mean, the main narrative's fine. I just didn't find myself massively drawn towards it. I was more into, like, speaking to, like, every weird character I came across to see what their wee stories were. Were you more drawn to finding out what was going on with this world, or were you, let me go my own way?
I think I come at it from a slightly different perspective because I was a fan of the first game.
Yeah.
And so Itsuna-san had said before, like, he said in interviews and stuff, so it's not like a spoiler to say this. And in fact, you know, it's complicated, right? But, like, the game makes a big point of, it's Dragon's Dogma 2 on the box, but when you boot it up, all the menus and the start screen and the title card all just say Dragon's Dogma. And that to some extent speaks to it speaks to an element of the game that's only within this game, which people will unfurl as they go. But then there's also an element of the game where this is sort of like an alternate world / retelling / remake of the story from Dragon's Dogma 1. And so I think people like me were constantly looking out for like clues as to what happened with Grand Sauron. Is it still around? Is this a different land, or is it the same land in an alternate universe, or the same land thousands of years before or after? And all those questions swirl around. So that was interesting. But I do think the story is better delivered than in Dragon's Dogma 1, but it's obviously just deliberately very loose. Mm. So obviously you've got the intrigue. I think the thing I liked is you could sort of, on the main story path, if you sort of want to abandon that intrigue, the palace intrigue angle of what the queen is up to and all that sort of stuff, you can follow that for a little bit and then just focus on yourself and focus on your connection to and relationship with the dragon and your relationship with your pawns and all that sort of stuff. But if you want that stuff, you can keep returning to the palace and like Captain Brent and Sven, the prince consort, they have strings and strings of new quests for you. And I was quite surprised how much more they had for you. And I think, you know, a lot of people will have just not seen a lot of that stuff because it's easy to just be focused on the grander adventure. So I think the story stuff is decent. I think it gets better as it goes along, but this isn't the game that you want if you want to be spoon-fed and told an epic tale with lots of cutscenes and stuff like that. A lot of the storytelling is environmental. A lot of the storytelling is in the dialogue between the pawns and in a very Soulsy fashion in item descriptions and stuff like that. And so there's sort of as much there as you want. Like if you just want an A to B to C story, I think there's just enough. But there's obviously more that you can have besides that. If you so desire. So I think it's fine, but this isn't that sort of game at the same time. It's a bit like how I legitimately don't even remember the story of Skyrim.
Oh, yeah. God. I didn't finish the story because I was busy doing everything else, like you're doing this, basically.
Yeah, I can remember Alduin, and that's about it.
You go to the mountain with the old blokes, they teach you to shout, and something happens. I can't remember.
Yeah, and I sort of remember Oblivion a little bit better, and Fallout 3 is quite vague to me. Fallout 4 I remember because it's just quite a strong hook. The father, or is it just the dad? Dad and the mom? Just the dad? I can't remember. Perfect example, right, of my point. And it's more in line with those games. But what I'd say is actually I think in terms of like the little bits of political intrigue and stuff they've got going on, even though there's less talking in this game than in like a Skyrim or something, I think the main story narrative is more interesting than those games. They've got lots of different intrigue going on about universes and the nature of the pawns and, you know, all that sort of stuff and narrative that bleeds into gameplay. Like, did anyone's pawn catch the disease?
Yes.
No, but my main pawn is starting to look haggard and they're starting to talk about it. Is that like a precursor to catching it? Like, or does it just happen?
Probably you've got it.
Like poker us? All right, okay.
But what I love about it is it's like in the some of the games media group chats, there were like people posting in all capital letters. Is it putting someone on blast? I suppose not. It's only a game. But like people putting in capital letters, do not hire Boss Fight Database's pawn, Boss Fight Database, the YouTube channel. It's got the disease.
That's
in
so
all
good.
Capitals in the chat. He's got- and everyone else going, everyone else going shit and checking their list of pawns and who their pawn has been with to see if they've had any contact with, with Boss Fight Database's pawn, which is really fun.
Because you can't control who they travel with. That's so clever, but also horrible.
None of mine contracted it, but it's sort of, and that's the thing, but it comes up a lot in conversation among the pawns. And I have to imagine that if one of your pawns does contract it, it probably leads down to quests and stuff like that, that sort of explain the nature of it. And that's where this game is, but that's the point. That's this whole wonderful little mechanical system that, you know, that exists, and I was aware of it, but I deliberately avoided it for the whole game. And And you know that when it's out, there's going to be people out there who are trying to deliberately spread it. And
The pawn system's like, I think it's great. My only grumble with the pawn system, and Jade, I wonder if you'll echo this where you are, they never shut up.
They constantly say
the same lines over and over again. The amount of times where someone will say, is that a ladder? Maybe we can climb that. I'll have been up there before. There's nothing left up there. That's like my only grumble with it. I think it's funny how when you go into like the Rift, every single pawn is a licensed character or like a celebrity or something like that, or just looks horrific. That's great.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Can I just quickly tell a story here?
Yeah, go
a story
for it.
I'm stealing from another member of the media, which is quite funny. There is a member of the media who will go unnamed who discovered a great way to make money in Dragon's Dogma, which was he kept leaving his pawn in a fairly scantily clad mode of dress. This was actually an RPG stats thing where just for whatever class his pawn was, this awful pervy bikini style outfit was the best thing for her to wear. But what he found was every time, this is just game journalists in a nutshell, every time his pawn, well, not every time, but many times when his pawn got hired, it would come back wearing really expensive clothes because they
dressed him up.
Because they wanted this high level pawn, but they didn't want to look at a bum for hours, or they were embarrassed about someone walking in. So members of the media we know sent this pawn back to someone else that we know, like dressed in really expensive cloaks that he could then sell for 10, 12, 15,000 gold.
Wow.
Just the pawn system's brilliant.
The clothes thing is funny because I played through the game as Paul Atreides, a very realistic Timothy Chalamet face model that I created. If I can remember, I'll shout out the YouTuber in the description for this. But then I was playing as an archer and I also got some extremely pervy clothing that, so as far as I'm aware, all the clothes are like gender neutral, like anyone can wear anything, I think.
Yeah.
So Paul Atreides had this tiny bra with massive like sleeves and then assless chaps. So anytime he fell flat on his face, you would just see his bum like fly in the air. Like, and it was hysterical. And maybe that's why I didn't take the main story too seriously, because every time there was a cutscene, it just cut to Timothy Chalamet wearing this regalia. But that stuff is, the pawn stuff is very funny. The amount of Kratoses that I've seen. Also, I had a moment where I had to reload a save because there's like a palace in Batal, and I left the palace and there was I can't remember the actual name of the creature, Alex, but it's like one of those big rock golems that has the magic medals all over it. One of them had made it into the town and all the people were fighting it, and then I died because it landed on me. And then I loaded it up again, and it was the like lion thing with the goat sticking out of it. But after that happened, like 7 times in a row, pawns came up to me and started speaking to me, and I was trying to cancel out and run away from them, but they were all going through that first bit of like, "I'll carry your weight for you. I'll carry your weight for you." I was like, "Oh, this is a funny ass game." Jade, any grumbles so far where you are?
Oh, I don't know. I'm kind of like the frustrations that I had initially, I've kind of learned to admire or like embrace the inherent embrace like the inherent ridiculousness of this game, because I feel like the foundations of the world building are immersive enough to pull you in, but then the pawns are just, they don't shut the fuck up. They're all dumb as shit. Like, the amount of times where I've like crossed a ravine and my main pawn has just fallen into a lake and died, and I've just audibly gone, mate! Just constant moments like that. But I think it is, because I mentioned that I haven't really done too much of the main narrative because I haven't found it particularly enthralling. But I think it's because this is the sort of game and has those systems that allow you to constantly make your own stories, like these water cooler moments, or the amount of like small videos or clips of big monster encounters that I've like sent on Slack and been like, oh my God, did you see this? I can't believe this happened. It feels like coincidental, but it's almost like the game is setting those things up for you, for like pawns to work together, or to you to work with random people procedurally entering the world where you're fighting like a Cyclops or something. Like, but as far as like small niggles go, I don't know. It's, there's a jank to this game, but I think it's, it feels almost deliberate in the way it's like honoring the first game, but also not trying to be every other open world game that's come out in the last 10 years, because it isn't. And I think that's its greatest strength, that it's willing to be the game that it is.
Not to be like hyper polished.
No. But also,
just curious, just before we continue, Alex, what are you playing it on? Platformers?
So this is exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. Where like so I played it on a face melter PC, so 14 100K, 64 gig of RAM, 4090. So that's a good four grand's worth of computer. So it's so I was, you know, and I had everything maxed out, DLSS on. I think it's a good looking game. I think when you stand on a vista and look out, It's a beautiful looking game, you know. I think the obvious comparison point, just because of relativity, is to like compare it to Rebirth, and I do think it's a, like, the character models. Actually, the character models are bloody good, to be fair. The main ones, Captain Brandt and that, like, really nice character models. But like, the character models don't have that full on beautiful charm of the Final Fantasy ones. But you stand on a cliff in Final Fantasy, and there's always a mega shit texture within sight somewhere on a rock or something. This game doesn't have that vibe. It's always really nice. But I played it on a really nice PC with DLSS enabled. I have played it on Xbox, and I have seen quite a bit of the PlayStation version. And I think that's the thing people need to, like, I've seen a lot of people bellyaching about this targeting 30 and not even necessarily hitting
it.
No,
not all the time.
But I think, but I think the thing people need to be aware of is this isn't, and they go, how can a game like that looks like this have that performance? But I think the thing that people need to nut up and think about and accept is that this is that CPU bounding. Like, it's because it's the amount of calculations that are going on in this world at any given second. But what that allows is for that emergent thing of the way characters interact with each other, the way characters interact with the world. It's actually the same problem that Bethesda have. And so when people complained about their engine and Starfield and the fact there were loads of load screens, why are there loads of load screens in Starfield? Because it would probably be impossible to fill your spaceship with potatoes and have all the physics work and stuff if there were no load screens. The load screens are what enable that, or to, you know, drop a gun somewhere and come back 80 hours later and the gun is in exactly the same place on exactly the same planet. That stuff is difficult to maintain in a fully open world, and so they have to make concessions, and the concession that they made is loaded zones. For good or for ill, that's another question. But the thing in Dragon's Dogma is they do have an open world, and they do have a high level of interactivity. Admittedly, you drop something, it's not going to be there 80 hours later. It's not like that. But the concession that they've had to make is that there's a lot of CPU computations going on at any given time, and therefore, on the consoles, which are starting to show their age now, the frame rate is going to be lower, and it's nothing to do with the visual fidelity of the game, really. It's to do with the amount of stuff that's popping off at all times. But what that unlocks for you is, like, those moments where you're fighting a big creature and it's a beautiful sunny day and you literally have the shadow of something much bigger go over
you. Those moments are incredible.
Yeah.
And you turn the camera up and you're like, shit, because this thing has seen the fight and is coming to join the fight. And all that is procedural. And I don't think you get that if you don't have that sort of... to get that, you have to have that griffin actually living in the world and flying around in the world in a non-scripted sort of manner. And you know, all the rest. And so I think that's why, and I think anyone who sort of writes this game off because it's, I don't know, 25 to 30 most of the time, would be missing out, unless you're the sort of person where a 30 FPS or sub 30 FPS frame rate literally turns your stomach. But I think those people are quite rare. But then again, I said this on Twitter when people were kicking off about that. I don't know if that, if my attitude is that way because I'm from the era when Ocarina of Time came out, was the greatest game ever made, and ran in PAL, because PAL was 20% slower, at like 19 FPS, and you just took it. You took what you could get.
Yeah. I don't think it's game ruining. The only times that it's ever really... it really shows when, ironically, when you're fighting the Drakes, so these are like lesser dragons that are kind of in the late game that you can fight, and when they come down and land on you, there's been times where it's been like slideshow, but it's not... It's not been super consistent. It's been inconsistent enough where when it happens, I go, "Oh, that's."
I've only had two moments like that where I'm like, "Frame rate," but beyond that, you do settle into that like cadence of like 30-ish FPS, and the combat is. I feel like a good comparison is like Monster Hunter, like the deliberacy of like executing moves. You need to have your timing and animations right to do the cool shit.
It's like Monster Hunter and DMC had a baby.
Yes, that's spot on. Yeah,
which makes sense because obviously Itsuno is the DMC guy, right?
Yeah,
but no, I was just
rocking with the bow. So rocking with the bow, sitting back, like breaking the game with these incendiary bolts that are so powerful that they
was that the Mystic Archer or the normal Archer?
Just the normal. I've not explored
you
the Mystic.
I played the Mystic
in preview. Same. Like when we were at Capcom, and getting that ricochet bolt was like the greatest fun I've ever had. I worry I might have missed my chance to get it just because I don't know why I'm doing like Trump hands, but I wonder.
No, you haven't. All that stuff, it's possible. I know what you're talking about. It's possible.
Okay, good, because I have been belly aching to my partner, just been like, wait till you see this pink ricochet arrow. It breaks the game. It's so good. I've enjoyed the combat. I've enjoyed that there's like basically no punishment for changing vocations. You get your vocation to level 10, then it goes. If you want to unlock another one, they are cheap as anything. You get so much XP for the vocational side of stuff. Go and do that. I also like that. I like that it's not a big skill tree web of nonsense, especially after playing Rebirth, having to like assign so much of that stuff in that big tree that took a million hours to do anything. I like that it's just you get a level up, yeah, a stat increase, and then you go through your vocations and you change that stuff.
But this comes back to what I said at the start, right? About it's refreshingly not bothered about what the current trends are.
No.
Yeah.
It's like, this is how we did the RPG systems last time. We're going to improve on it, grow it a little bit. We're not going to create a bloody skill tree that looks like Spider-Man and God of War and every other game. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a hell of a game. I think that I hope people like plow on with it. There's an early quest where you're basically told to go to the capital, and I know it's easy to do this because I did it. You can lose the person that you're meant to follow to the capital, and then you just have to make your own way. Yeah, and it's like I had the experience of like, okay, there's no, I've just got to plow through here, and it takes ages. Like it feels like it's taken so long that you're like, I must be going in the wrong direction here. But then when you go around a certain corner and it all appears, it's like, okay, this feels like the Lord of the Rings. Like it feels like those aerial shots of them running across like Middle Earth. Like that's what the adventuring in this feels like. It's so, Alex, just that is them, like, it's so Dungeons and Dragons-y.
That is them signaling though, like there's no guardrails here.
Yeah.
This is a game that literally in the first 30 minutes at some point pops up a thing that is like, there is an autosave, but do not trust the autosave. Save often.
Yeah,
which is quite an astonishing thing for a game to put in a tutorial pop-up. And it's hard to explain why that makes sense, but when you play the game, you will understand. And I mean, I like that there's no guardrails, but what this feels like to me and what I predict for this is a bit like how, this is my read of the situation. You had Demon's Souls, and Demon's Souls was a cult hit, and real internet nerds loved it and thought it was brilliant, and it sold decently, like, I don't know, a couple of million copies or something like that. It was a big deal for Atlus, who at that time, selling a million copies of anything was a big slam dunk for them. you know, the era when Persona was only selling 2 million and was their biggest franchise. And then you had Dark Souls. And when Dark Souls came out, you had a slightly higher percentage of people who got it and evangelized for it. And then you fast forward 8 years after that and you get Dark Souls 3 and everyone suddenly seemed to get it. And now you've got Elden Ring and it's like one of the biggest games on the market. And I do think, I don't think this is that Elden Ring moment for Dragon's Dogma, but what I do think is you will have a similar move from the first game, which was a cult hit, to as you got from Demons to Dark for the Souls games. But I think what's interesting is Demons to Dark was quite a quick turnaround, like 4 or 5 years, something like that. Was it 2009 and 2011 or 2008, 2011, something like that?
Yeah.
And this, there's been 12 years. And so what has happened in those 12 years is they've re-released Dragon's Dogma 3 times on pretty much every platform you can possibly imagine. But also, crucially, it has just become a cult hit. I mean, do not... Well, Itsuno told me off for calling it a cult hit when I interviewed him. he said to me, and he is right to be fair, he said, it's been a long time since the first game came out. I don't think we need to call it a cult hit anymore. We can just say that it's a popular, well-selling series. Because when the game first came out, the initial version of Dragon's Dogma 1 sold like 1.5 million copies. But then over the subsequent releases, it's now, like, I think in the top 15 Capcom games ever in terms of sales when you add the various versions together. Like, it's over 7 million, pushing 8 million. And those numbers, that's Final Fantasy numbers. Mm. That's, you know, that's Persona numbers. Like, so this isn't necessarily all that. And those are the numbers that Dark Souls did up until Dark Souls 3 when suddenly it did 8, 9, 10 million. And so one wonders, do those 7 million people who bought the first game and over the years became converted by its culty charms, do they just rock up on day one for this? I mean, it's not going to sell 7 million copies on day one, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. I think it will do pretty well. I think the only thing working against it is still in the kind of afterglow of Rebirth, even though I know those games don't like set the world on fire sales-wise or anything like that. Like, that's kind of a big problem for Square Enix.
I just think in market potential and stuff, this... I think Rebirth is a good game. Can't stress that enough. Gave it 4 stars. It's great. But I think this, in terms of the potential market and stuff like that, and the potential people it can reach and the potential people who can really fall in love with it, I think this shit's all over Rebirth.
Do you think
it's
close. That's the quote. That's the quote for the thumbnail. The shit's all over Rebirth.
Square will be thrilled with that.
In comparison to when the original Dragon's Dogma came out, was it 2012? Do you think, like, mainstream gaming audiences now are more ready for a game like Dragon's Dogma?
I do, because we've had Souls, because we've had Baldur's Gate.
That's what
I'm thinking. We've had these more crunchy, hardcore RPGs, and if Capcom manages to position it right, it is just saying, hey, we're another one of those. Mm. But actually, we've got our own sort of... I think it will stand to do really well on PC. Like, I could see this being a huge hit on Steam. We'll see where it lands in sort of the Steam activity charts. But I really hope it gets that success, because it's brilliant. And actually, the most exciting thing, I think, although we're looking ahead a little bit, is Dragon's Dogma 1 had, in my opinion, one of the best expansions that's ever been put to paper for a game like this. Dark Arisen was incredible. It made changes to the main game. It added a bunch of stuff. It added a really long and extremely attractive and engaging post-game. And if they do that with this game again, long-term, it could be a huge success. And I really hope it is, because I genuinely do think... Well, I don't know. The last time I was this high on a game was Elden Ring.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And in the very back end of this game, you know, not getting into any specific spoilers, but this game does stuff that... There's a particular thing it does where I actually laughed out loud so loud that I woke my 2-year-old daughter, because I was just like, a thing happened and I was just like, yes! And just laughed because it felt so ridiculous and so right and so brilliant. And Jordan knows what I'm talking about. And, you know, there's moments in this game that made me feel things that I very seldom feel, like moments in this game that sort of scratched that near itch.
Yes, it's so near. You're right. Oh my God. You've nailed it. Fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Or there's moments in this game that, like, One of my favorite video game moments of all time, right, is when I unlocked overtime mode in Dead Rising for the first time. So that's when you realize, after probably playing through Dead Rising like 4 or 5 times, and you get to the end of the
like,
three
I'm
days
free now. After, what do I do? Like that kind of thing.
You realize that, yeah, that actually the story continues, and you're like, holy shit. Because if you didn't have a guide or whatever, which they were a lot less common then, that could genuinely be a surprise. And, you know, there's moments like that, or moments like doing the suicide mission in Mass Effect 2 without having a guide to tell you. That was one of my favorite reviews of all time to work on, because there was not even any option of Googling it. So proper like squeaky bum time, making the choices of who does what in the final mission. Cause you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen. And this game has moments and things that it does that give me those sorts of highs. And I love a lot of games, but that very, very, very rarely happens that I get those feelings.
I've still got a lot to see despite having played it a bunch. But I do think it's quite extraordinary. It's kind of like the antidote I've needed after a lot of the open world games I've played recently. As good as they were, it's kind of reminded me the joy that can come from being let loose in a world where like anything is possible, but also it challenges and forces you to think on your feet. But yeah, I haven't even touched Batal yet, so I'm really curious to see where this goes.
It's the best game of the year so far, and I literally just was looking it up as we were talking. Like, I'm looking at the rest of the release list for the rest of the year. I think for me, it will take some beating, to be honest. It does all the right things. And yes, it isn't beautiful in the way, you know, it isn't this beautiful, highly, tightly wound, curated thing, like a big Sony first party spectacle or something like that. But it's just, it's a video game ass video game. It's real shit. And we don't get enough of that now. And it makes you, and because of that, because it's that sort of game, it makes you feel like you really embody that world more, and you embody that character more in those relationships, which sort of makes up for the ways in which they're slightly deficient, more than makes up for it.
Thanks for checking out our review cast of Dragon's Dogma 2 here on VGC, the video game podcast. Apologies for the abrupt ending. We had some technical difficulties, but you only missed about 5 minutes at the end of the podcast with me telling the story of how two trolls fought a griffin, but you should get to experience that for yourself in Dragon's Dogma 2. If you'd like to check out our full review, check out VGC. Thanks again to Alex and Jade for coming on. They're always a pleasure to talk to. You can follow them on Twitter at APZoneRunner for Alex and at KonaYMA6 for Jade. Until next time on VGC, the video game podcast, I'm Jordan Midler. See you later.
VGC, a video games podcast, is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.